Okay, good. So the important point that I would like to make is a principled point, a theory point, which is that in more than one dimension, charge density wave order, and this also, I think, holds for spin density wave order, which is the aspect of this that will probably upset people more, but I haven't really completely thought that part through, so that's in parentheses. But charge density wave order is generically, first place, not a weak coupling instability, not related to Fermi surface nesting, and not well described in the context of mean field theory. Okay, so that's the main things I'm going to talk about. If I have time, I will get to the coup rates, and I will try to convince you that contrary to what 99% of the people who are thinking about this believe, that the charge density wave order in the coup rates is not related to Fermi surface nesting, doesn't have much effect on the quasi-particle spectrum at all, and is probably some form of parasitic order.
You're keeping your promise. I'm not irritated.
Good. But you're only one. It's a start. Okay, so let's just think about how you would describe charge density wave order in mean field theory, and in particular how you would calculate TC. So you would calculate the particle hole susceptibility of your non-interacting system at, it's a function of wave vector Q and temperature, then you'd multiply it by whatever the interaction strength is at that Q, and whenever this is equal to one, that's TC. And in particular, you'd look around for the ordering vector by finding out at which value of Q does this have the highest transition temperature. And that, you would say, is your mean field charge density wave ordering temperature. Now, clearly from this expression, I mean, still sticking within mean field theory, the ordering vector is determined by the band structure only to the extent that chi is strongly peaked as a function of Q. If it's not strongly peaked as a function of Q, then it's some compromise between the band structure effects and the interaction effects. The other thing that's clear is that since chi grows as you lower temperature, that at the very least to get charge density wave ordering, the interaction must be bigger than 1 over the susceptibility. Now, in one dimension, all of this works nicely. The susceptibility is highly peaked at Q equals 2 kF. In fact, at zero temperature, it diverges logarithmically at Q equals 2 kF. And
Dave, could you stand further back so that those of us on the side can see the screen? Fine. You don't have to be that far.
Maybe I can go over here, actually. And it grows logarithmically as you lower the temperature. And this is what Pyrrhals noticed. This is such a powerful graphic that it's sort of what we have in our minds usually when we think about charge density wave order. Here's a picture. The gray curve is this susceptibility at zero temperature, and then these various curves, ignore the orange, I'm not exactly sure what the orange is, but these other curves are this thing rounded as we raise the temperature. And so already what you see here is since this is a logarithmic effect, even when the temperature is quite low compared to characteristic energies in the problem, this peak really goes away very quickly. Okay, now if we think of a quasi one-dimensional system, we no longer have perfect nesting. And so what that means is that if we take some one-dimensional system and turn on weak interchain coupling, we generically round this off at, you might think of it as a effective temperature at which a dimensional crossover occurs from one-dimensional to two-dimensional physics. And so since this characteristically one-dimensional divergence is so sensitive to temperature, it's also very sensitive to being rounded off in higher dimensions. In two dimensions, well, for a circular Fermi surface in two dimensions, chi is independent of q and is just equal to the density of states out to q equals 2kF. And generically, in two dimensions, chi isn't strongly q-dependent at all. And in three dimensions, it's even worse. It has its maximum at zero q and drops as q increases. So the behavior of higher dimensional systems is very different from this sort of one-dimensional cartoon that we have in mind when we think about Fermi surface nested. Yes?
So what about nested surfaces?
Right, so I'll talk about exceptions. So this is generic circumstances. Here already I've explained to you one of these examples that, okay, a quasi one-dimensional system is close to being a one-dimensional system, which has perfect nesting. So that's a fine-tuned circumstance. But the point is that it rounds off very quickly. So you need to be very fine-tuned in order to get much advantage out of it. The susceptibility at the peak value depends logarithmically on this small parameter. So in order to get it big, you need the log, 1 over the log of your small parameter to be big. So the conclusions from this directly at mean field level is that V is going to play a big role, even at mean field level, in determining the charge density wave ordering. Let me make a digression to one aspect of this that has been stressed in quite an interesting paper by Igor Mazin on this subject, which is that there's probably a still narrower definition of what you mean by Fermi surface nesting. Fermi surface nesting has to do with the behavior of the states with energy right at the Fermi energy. Chi here, the susceptibility, involves an integral over all the occupied states, and so it has some dependence on all the states below the Fermi energy. But chi double prime at some small frequency, because of the energy conserving delta function, this is the thing that tells you about Fermi surface nesting. So if you wanted to ask, does this ordering vector have something to do with Fermi surface nesting, you might want to compare the ordering vector not with the peak of chi, but with the peak of chi double prime. And that turns out to be even less of a successful undertaking. The second thing that you see from this is that since chi doesn't get to be big compared to the density of states, in order to get charge density wave at all, V has to be bigger than 1 over the density of states, which means, again, generically without fine-tuning, that V has to be larger than the Fermi energy. And so charge density waves occur only in intermediate to strong coupling problems. States near the Fermi energy should be expected to play no special role in the charge ordering phenomenon. And in fact, there's no particular reason to think that mean field theory should be successful, given that you're making modifications to states all through the width of the band due to the interactions.
Is your argument not a little bit, or the other way around? You're saying now most systems are not charge density waves.
There are lots of charge density wave systems, and we'll see that they all satisfy these. You're right. There would be a possibility that charge density wave systems were so rare that it was only when they managed to be non-generic in one of these senses, but that's not the case. I'll get to specific examples in a minute. And so one of the other consequences of this that we're now familiar with in the high temperature superconductivity community, but which is a little bit of a shock from this point of view, is that this means that you would expect in charge density wave systems that the order shouldn't go away sharply at TC, that you should have some form of local order and pseudo gaps, which are to say non-mean field character, that should persist above the charge density wave ordering transition. As I was preparing this talk, I received a really lovely preprint, which unfortunately is still under embargo, but there's a long list of authors that you can pester, and I'm sure they would be willing to send it to you directly, where they look at the classic charge density wave system, niobium diselenide, and show that all of these things occur very vividly in that system. Okay. So now I'm going to get to Shankar's objection. There certainly are non-generic situations in which chi of Q is highly peaked, even in higher dimensions. One example, which is probably the most robust example, is 2D systems with quadratic band touching. There, because of charge neutrality, you can be automatically tuned to the Fermi energy being at the point of quadratic band touching. And then if you're lucky, you still have a logarithmic divergence in the susceptibility, which can allow some of these weak coupling effects to occur. The other place where I actually thought for a long time was a good example, which is the rare earth tritellurides, where although they're two-dimensional, practically tetragonal systems, they have a band structure that has a hidden quasi-1D character, very similar to the way that strontium ruthenate has these famous quasi-1D bands. This was interesting because I thought this was a nice weak coupling system, but it's tetragonal and it has stripe order, so it seemed like a nice warm-up problem for the stripes and the cuprates. Let me just explain where this 1D structure comes from. The relevant orbitals here are p orbitals, and the p orbitals look sort of like this. They're either px or py orbitals, and the px orbitals have much bigger overlap in the x direction than in the y direction, and the py orbitals have much bigger overlap in the y direction than the x direction. So the band structure to first approximation just looks like two sets of intersecting 1D bands. And so although overall the system is tetragonal, the electronic structure is quasi one-dimensional, and there's a fair degree of nesting that occurs there. And that therefore, in the limit, you could imagine at least adiabatically continuing from the limit where we made these things as one-dimensional as you like, and we could get some weak coupling understanding of the phase diagram of these materials. In this paper that I've recommended to you by Igor Mazin, this was my version of a band structure calculation. This is Igor Mazin's results from DFT. This is chi of Q at t equals zero. And, you know, it's pretty encouraging. There are peaks in chi of Q. They're not very big. There's an offset zero here, but at least there are peaks in chi of Q, and those peaks actually do occur at the charge ordering vector. So this is, I think, the best example of something where mean field theory isn't such a bad starting point. Now, Igor is making a somewhat different point here. You see this arrow here. That arrow there is because if you calculate chi double prime of Q to ask where does Fermi surface nesting occur, turns out Fermi surface nesting occurs at a point that's way off from where the charge density wave ordering occurs. So even here, this peak is something that comes from the entire band, not particularly from states near the Fermi surface. And then again, you know, the timing of this is sort of peculiar, but I started receiving emails, and in particular, I got this paper, and it turns out that even in this, which I think is probably the best case because it has these quasi one-dimensional band structures, there's all sorts of emerging evidence that, in fact, the band structure effect is a relatively modest contributor to the charge density wave ordering phenomenon, and that the wave vector is chosen as much by aspects of the electron-phonon coupling as by aspects of the electronic structure.
Steve, just to clarify, what house are we trying to make? Are you trying to say that there are no S-A-induced charge density waves, even one?
No. So obviously in 1D this works beautifully. What? Yeah, sure.
So obvious.
Yeah. Now, you know, one of the things in one dimension, though, is it is, so even in one dimension it's hard. Because, you know, in two dimensions there are sort of two limits you could imagine. One is weak coupling, in which the charge density wave occurs at 2kF, if you're lucky. And the other is strong coupling, where it's a Wigner crystal, where it occurs at 2 pi over the spacing between particles. Now, in more than one dimension, those two wave vectors have nothing to do with each other. But in one dimension, they're exactly the same. So if I told you I don't believe in 2kF, I'm going to start with a one-dimensional Wigner crystal and allow quantum fluctuations to melt it, I'll get just as good a picture of the charge density waves you see in quasi one-dimensional systems. So in that case, there's a smooth evolution from weak to strong coupling, okay, which means that we don't have to ever fight it out. It's good from either limit. All right. But anyway, I'm not going to object if you want to look at one-dimensional systems in terms of Fermi surface nesting. That's certainly a cartoon that works quite well. The field-induced spin density wave systems, I agree with you as well. Yeah, and there it's really Fermiology. Yeah, I agree. Let's see, I think I'm going the wrong direction. I also wanted to just flash one thing. You know, we're studying charge density wave phenomena in the cuprates, and we look for these barely detectable little bumps in X-ray diffraction. When people talk about charge density waves, say in the rare earth tritellurides, there are these zillions of new Bragg peaks that they see in X-ray diffraction. And when they talk about quantum oscillations associated with the reconstructed Fermi surface, I mean, they see quantum oscillations. It's really a pleasure. Okay. So I think I still have time. I will say a few things, one thing really, about the cuprates. So in the last few years, one of the big developments in the field is that people have started to see charge density wave phenomena ubiquitously in the cuprates. And having been sort of considered to be a madman for a quarter of a century for saying that charge density wave phenomena might be important in the cuprates, that obviously makes me happy. But there are a number of problems that I would like to highlight. So first, as I said, what's seen universally in the cuprates now is that there's some sort of short-range correlated, that is to say finite correlation length, charge density wave order with ordering vectors along the copper oxide directions in both directions. And this has now been seen in, well, the traditional materials, stripe ordered materials, where people had documented these for many years, and in other whole doped cuprates, and most recently in the electron doped cuprates as well. So that's nice. But now, yes?
Sorry, I thought that the LDCO is not bidirectional.
It is bidirectional.
In stripy?
Okay, stripy is some microscopic within the unit cell description. You see, LBCO is tetragonal. So in fact, unlike YBCO, you see exactly the same amount of scattering intensity in these two peaks as that those two peaks. It's not approximate. The only one in which there's some approximation of unidirectional scattering is in ortho 2 YBCO. Now, the microscopic understanding of where this comes from is that there's two layers per unit cell in LBCO, one in which the stripe charge density wave is dominantly in this direction, and the other where it's dominantly in that direction. We don't have that level of understanding of what the local structure is here. In fact, I'm not sure that the question is even defined in these because the correlation length is so short. In this material, the correlation length is long enough that you can imagine refining what the microscopic structure of the charge density wave is. Here, disorder is so dominant that I'm not even sure that that's a well-defined question. Okay? Okay, so now I want to get to my points. So this is not related to Fermi surface nesting. It doesn't much affect the quasiparticle spectrum. This actually is a conclusion I'm dragged to kicking and screaming, because it sort of has with it the suggestion that maybe it's not very important. And it's probably some parasitic order. So here is a picture of what some of these diffraction peaks look like. And you can see, even in the best cases, they're fairly broad. They're fairly weak. So here's what I want to do. Rather than directly attacking the question of what is the origin of the charge density wave and how is the charge density wave affected by the electrons at the Fermi energy, I want to ask the opposite question. I want to ask, how are the electrons at the Fermi energy affected by the charge density wave? And so they presumably, if phi is my charge density wave order parameter, which is at some wave vector q, then it couples to the low energy electronic excitations of the system by scattering an electron from a state with momentum k to a state with momentum k plus q. And this process is proportional to the strength of the charge density wave order parameter and some coupling constant. Now, if we look on a point on the Fermi surface where one point on the Fermi surface, some KF on the Fermi surface, is related to some other point on the Fermi surface by this charge density wave ordering vector, then we know exactly what happens to the spectrum at that point. The spectrum gets split with a gap that's directly proportional to this coupling. And if we move a little away from this, we should see some dispersion where this plays the role of the gap. Okay, now here are some figures from some of the papers on this charge density wave phenomena, in this case in bismuth 2201 and bismuth 2212, and they're trying to argue that the charge density wave ordering vector has something to do with the so-called nodal arcs. And so here they've shown a picture. In red here is a picture of where there is zero energy spectral weight measured by ARPIS in the Brillouin zone. So these are the arcs. And this is a picture of the charge density wave ordering vector. And, you know, this picture makes things look better than it is. The ends of these arcs are not very well defined. But the thing that you know is that, notice here, is that there's no gap at that point. And you notice that here, this is showing where different possible ordering vectors might appear on the Fermi surface here. But again, the actual ordering vector that's seen in this material is this, and it occurs at the end of the arc where the gap is zero. So, as far as I know, everywhere we know both the spectrum and the ordering vector in the whole Dove-Coupe rates spans portions of the Fermi surface where the gap within experimental error is equal to zero.
So Steve, from the previous slide where you calculated the gap in terms of some parameter is really small.
So, okay, so that's, it's zero within experimental error. I'll come back, you know, you're always one slide ahead of me. You're just too fast for me. Of course, zero is not a respectable number in experiment, so we'll talk about what that means. But for now, it's zero within experiment. Here's the electron dope material. In the electron dope material, there are these fantastic hotspots. This is, again, a picture of where there's low energy spectral weight, zero energy spectral weight is measured by ARPIS, and you see that the Fermi surface is broken up along this antiferromagnetic Grignard zone boundary, and there's no spectral weight here and there. But here's the ordering vector, which now spans more or less these antinodal points, where in the whole dope-Coupe rates there would have been a gap, but in the electron dope-Coupe rates, these are again places on the Fermi surface where there's no gap. Yes?
If I may, but could one not connect those hotspots between the different arcs, not this way, but diagonally, where Q would be 5 points?
There are many ways we could connect things, but this is the ordering vector, and it connects this point to this point.
But what I'm saying is that you have chosen a commensurate order.
I haven't chosen. This is the measured order. Sorry, I'm not doing theory here.
No,
I'm drawing here a picture. This is the charge ordering vector, and it connects these 2 points on the Fermi surface.
And that's experimentally seen, that's what you're saying.
That's experimentally seen. There's no theory here.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think in this case, those portions are really quite flat, right? So you really have to have very high resolution to be able to say that it's really the antinode rather than the hotspot, which is connected by the order.
I agree with you, but that's not my point. My point is these spots are connected by the charge ordering vector. Okay, I'm not trying to, in this slide, to tell you what caused the charge density wave. I'm trying to ask, where do I expect the presence of a charge density wave to have opened a gap in the spectrum? And unambiguously, it should have opened a gap in the spectrum here, and it hasn't. Okay, so that's every place where I know both the charge ordering vector and the structure of the Fermi surface. Now I'm going to get to Shankar's question. How big might I expect that gap to be? Well, if nesting were somehow related to the mechanism of charge density wave order, then I gain condensation energy by opening that gap, and that condensation energy has to be big enough to give me a transition temperature that's comparable to where they see the onset of charge density wave order, so it means the gap must be bigger than something like 2T charge density wave, equal is the sort of mean field value, and in non-mean field cases, TC gets suppressed by fluctuation, so this number would be even bigger, which means an estimate of something like 40 millivolts. So if I were to think that somehow gapping of the Fermi surface was related to the mechanism of superconductivity, I would expect gaps like this, and I've made a rough estimate, and nobody's disagreed with me among the experimentalists that I've talked to, that they would certainly see a gap of 5 millivolts. So this number is something like an order of magnitude bigger than a bound people would be prepared to put on what the gap is. So either somehow the charge density wave order is very weak, or somehow its coupling is very weak at these important points on the Fermi surface. This doesn't tell us which. Now, I do know that there are all sorts of changes in transport properties that occur at around the temperature at which the charge density wave order onsets, which somehow means that at least some aspect of the charge density wave order is important for the electron dynamics. So my guess is that probably the coupling isn't weak. and that it's the charge density wave order parameter that's somehow small. And that leaves us with another problem. If the charge density wave order is somehow small, then how does it manage to order at high temperature? And so the way that can happen is if it's a subsidiary order, if there's some other primary order that has energy scales that are reasonable, and that the charge density wave order occurs as a parasite, as say quadratic in the primary order parameter, in which case the charge density wave gaps would be something like the primary gap squared, or in other words, it would be down from what you would expect by a factor of the charge density wave onset temperature over the Fermi energy, which is certainly easy to explain why it's not observed. And naturally, that leaves open the question of what is the primary order parameter. Yes?
Is it possible there's an enhanced symmetry if that coefficient is zero?
Here I've just guessed that this is zero, is not zero. You could certainly imagine some other scenario where, for some reason, in these important parts of the Fermi surface, that this coupling is zero for some reason. So this is the only part of the talk where I'm doing any theory, and so it's the only part of the talk where I'm quite certain that some of the things I'm saying are wrong. All right, so that's...
Are there theories of these arcs, is that right?
No. I mean, okay, not, there are no theories of the arcs that
there's
I understand.
No way to compute alpha.
What?
No way to compute alpha within any given theory.
Yeah, alpha is easy. I mean, any reasonable theory you put down will give alpha of order one. The thing that's hard to do is to write down a theory that has arcs. I mean, arcs don't make any sense. You know, if we didn't see them in experiment, you wouldn't be talking about them. Okay, so that's it. I have some references and which will be available, and so there were my conclusions. And I was almost in the time I was supposed to be.
Perfect.
So Steve, I would agree with many things you said, but there is, for me, still there is a question of this monolayer BSCO with the RPS experiments. And they see this opening of a gap at a Fermi wave vectors, which is larger than wave vector, which are larger than the Fermi wave vector. So they attribute that to the charge order. And when you see the gap, it's big. It's not small. Like a monolayer BSCO, like the Shen experiment, Shen group.
Sorry, again, I showed data here from single layer BSCO.
Yeah.
So there's substantial gaps out here.
Yes, so
the
attribute
but
that
the way the ordering vector spans the Fermi surface, not at the antinode, but at the end of the arc. So I haven't, there is a gap here, that's the pseudo gap. That's certainly an important thing to understand.
Wait a second. Whatever create this gap, first this gap is big.
Yes.
And whatever create this gap is the same wave vector as the charge order.
No. The gap here, that's what this figure is showing for bilayer BSCO. This wave vector here is substantially shorter.
No, it's
than
what
the charge
I say. So it has the same wave vector as the observed charge order,
no.
Like the QH.
This is the observed charge
yes.
order,
yeah.
And this is the spanning vector of the
yeah,
antinode.
But the gap opens at the bigger wave vector. Then the gap, that's exactly the point
the,
of
the,
the
you
gap
mean
opens.
The shift of KF.
Yes.
There is a shift of KF.
Yes,
there.
So then the gap opens at the charge order wave vector.
No, the gap isn't open to the charge ordering vector. Here's where this...
If you put the... the gap doesn't open at KF, it does open at a wave vector larger than KF, and this wave vector is
So it's very complicated what's going on out here. In fact, the spectrum is enormously complex there. I actually happen to be a co-author on that paper. And I can assure you that the spectrum cannot be fit by a charge density wave. But the arguments about that are extremely complicated and involved very large discussions among that group of collaborators, because we tried very hard to fit it with a charge density wave. But I'm moving away from complexity here. This point is a point on the Fermi surface that is spanned by the charge density wave order vector. So this is where the analysis should be simple. Here you have to do all sorts of things because this Fermi, the charge density, the charge ordering vector does not span the Fermi surface. Also out here, there's presumably big effects of superconducting fluctuations.
So just to make things clear, like I heard many times say, like it cannot be fit with a charge order, and it's plus superconductor because we're in a superconducting phase.
No, we're not in a superconducting phase. All of this data is taken above TC, where the charge density wave order is strongest and where we don't have an ordered superconducting state. I've purposely taken data only in the normal state. I mean, there are still some superconducting gaps due to fluctuations, but that's a very complicated problem that we don't know how to solve.
Okay, well, like to make my point, then if you take this superconducting gap plus charge order, then it's fitting much better.
So none of these things fit very well out here, but my point is I don't need to look at this complex problem. I look at the place where I understand the simple problem.
This I would agree with.
Okay, maybe let's move on.
This is good. This is what I was trying to do.
Peter was first.
Well, it's just a follow-on. I mean, I think you don't want to go into theories of arcs, or you don't understand them. I'm not quite sure which.
I'd love to go into theories of arcs. I just don't understand them.
There's a class of ideas which suggest that these arcs are defined not because a gap is going to zero, an order parameter is going to zero, but because the scattering rate is very large, right? And so if you have that, you can have a hidden order parameter which is finite at the tips of those arcs.
You can. So that's why.
Solve your problem?
So that's why that's where my 5 millivolts comes from. So the question I've asked sort of everybody in this field is, how big of a gap do you think there could be there that you wouldn't detect? And so,
we're not talking about a spectral gap which you're not detecting. We're talking about a zero spectral gap, but a large order parameter hidden by a large scattering.
So what they've done, people have done, is they've done modeling of the spectra in terms of a gap and a scattering rate. Mm-hmm. And so then you ask yourself, how big of a gap could you get away with? And it's around 5 millivolts. I mean, look, you know, the quantitative estimates are, of course, the hard part.
People argue that eta alpha is small or pi is small, right?
I guess they could both be small.
Right. Now, you said alpha is order 1 because any calculation will give you alpha order 1.
Yeah.
But it seems to be...
But that actually wasn't... my argument for alpha being 1... Okay, it could be like Mike said, that alpha was 0 just on these spots on the Fermi surface.
I mean, I don't know enough to...
Yeah,
no,
look, it's possible.
Unless you understand the arcs.
Yeah. What I do know is that alpha can't be zero over most of the Fermi surface because we see very substantial effects of the charge onset of charge order on the transport. And therefore, we know that the electrons at the Fermi surface are being significantly modified by the onset of charge.
We focus only on this point and break it as a premise.
Absolutely. So it is possible that alpha vanishes at this point. That is a logical possibility. I agree. That of course also answers the question about whether this can be contributing to the mechanism of charge density wave phenomena. I mean, you know, if alpha is zero for the effect of the charge density wave on the quasiparticles at the Fermi surface at their nesting point, alpha is also zero for the effect of the quasiparticles at their nesting point on the charge density wave.
Yeah,
that's Newton's third law.
I don't care what happens. I just wanted to understand which of the options you're leading us with. And one option is that for some reason, alpha is computed in the theory of arcs. Could be very small in these ends.
Yeah, yeah. These aren't symmetry points on the Fermi surface. So, but look, I agree with you. I'm not. I'm. I'm agnostic on this.
So you were hesitant at the beginning about the spin density wave case. Is that because in that case it's more difficult to have escape route or some
Primary
order?
So the general principled arguments I went through apply equally in the spin density wave as they do to the charge density wave. What I've done here is I've spent quite a bit of time looking at conventional charge density wave systems that traditionally people thought were driven by Fermi surface nesting. And I've discovered that in each case, as people have looked at it more carefully in recent years with better resolution and with new experimental probes, that understanding has fallen apart. The thing that makes me hesitant to make the same statement about spin density waves is that there are equally assertive statements that chromium can be understood as a Fermi surface nesting effect. And my suspicion is that if we go back and look at chromium with the same level of scrutiny that we've been looking at these charge density wave systems, we will find that that statement's not true. But I haven't looked at it, and so I didn't want to I want to make sure there isn't a flaming counterexample to my statements. So that's why the parentheses.
I think chromium actually is not fully understood, so it's still out there.
Is it a common observation that the effect of the charge at density wave connects somehow endpoints of these arcs?
So this is one of the very recent discoveries that people have been excited about in the cuprates. And the arcs are a special thing to cuprates. I mean, I don't know of other materials that have arcs.
Right, but so is that a generic with respect to doping and materials?
Yeah. So one of the troubles is that there aren't that many materials where we have both data on charge ordering and ARPIS. But in both bismuth 2201 and bismuth 2212, there is data on both over a range of dopings. And the claim of the experimentalists is that they track each other. Okay? I'm a little suspicious of that claim because the end of the arc, for reasons that Peter was alluding to, is actually a little bit criterion dependent. So the statement in these papers is that they track each other over a range of doping.
And again, this is partly because I haven't followed the literature in the book race, but what I recall is the STM data on this clock.
Yeah.
Right? Coming from Shamus Davis group, show that those 8 points, right, two on each arc, can also be seen in quasi-particle interference. Are those 8 points the same as the points at the ends of the arc that allegedly connected by charge density wave?
So, first place, you're discussing experiments that are performed in a different phase of matter. Very important to remember that the QPI you're talking about are measured at low temperature deep in the superconducting state. And this data that I'm talking about is measured above TC in a regime where there presumably wouldn't be such QPI.
Right.
The QPI tend to reside on the portions of the Fermi surface that will later be the arcs when you heat the system up above TC.
Right.
I'm not exactly sure what to say about that other than to say that the single particle spectrum inferred from QPI is inconsistent with the single particle spectrum inferred from ARPIS in the same range of temperatures. Okay, and that's not good, but I'll stop.
Luke.
So the model you used to describe this gap opening actually assumes the long range order of your phi, right? But you said that wasn't
good. So that is another loophole, is that these correlation lengths are short, and I've treated this as a fully ordered system. This is static. It's not fluctuating order. I mean, this is
slow.
What?
It's low.
But the correlations are local. And so one should really do calculations with disordered versions of the charge density wave, which will spread things out. But every such calculation that I know of still produces a big peak, a big gap. The gap is blurry, but a big gap at the nesting vector. So there have been lots of such calculations done over the years. And in fact, that's also what's seen in niobium diselenide above the charge ordering temperature. That's what this new paper is reporting, that they see pseudogaps that look just like residuals of the gap of the long-range ordered state.
Those arc lengths are a function of temperature? Is it consistent with the...
Yeah, so they don't seem to be very... So there was a lot of controversy about that also. In the early days, the arcs were found to be strongly temperature-dependent. Now they're found to be weakly temperature-dependent, and I don't know just what changed. Anyway, these are the arcs as reported just above TC. So I'm comparing arcs. They're comparing arc lengths at the same temperature that they're also measuring the charge ordering. So presumably, whatever temperature dependence is folded into that.
So, can I ask a question? So you said one logical possibility would be that it's a secondary order parameter.
Yeah.
But then the primary order parameter should be strong and should show up, I don't know, a specific heat or some strong signature of a phase transition, and there appears to be none.
Right. So I agree with you. Now, there are, so first place, there's the specific heat. So let me address that first. So the specific heat in these materials more or less can't be measured at these temperatures. There are measurements of it, but they involve subtracting off numbers that are huge compared to the signal you're looking at. So the only thing that you could hope to see would be a sharp critical anomaly. So then what you have to imagine is whatever the order parameter is, it has a phase transition that's rounded in some way. Now, these are disordered systems, so as long as the order parameter involves breaking of spatial symmetries, you do in fact expect it to be rounded. And so I think that there's a perfectly good reason to not have seen a critical anomaly in the specific heat. This is where some things like the ultrasound experiments come in, and people are starting to see things. I don't know that it's sorted out exactly. It's not sorted out in my mind exactly what they're seeing. It may be sorted out in somebody's mind. But all of that is apologies. If it's the big order parameter, you should be able to see it directly. So I know lots of things that it isn't. For instance, a perfect example of an order parameter that would behave like this would be a spin density wave order parameter. So if psi were spin density wave at wave vector q over 2, then we would form a composite like this, and you get a subsidiary charge density wave at wave vector q. That's well known. That happens in chromium, for instance. But we know from neutron scattering that there's no low energy magnetism at all in these materials. It could be an incommensurate d-density wave. That turns out to be fiendishly difficult to detect. It involves time reversal symmetry breaking, so I think it would have showed up in NMR and BUSR, but there aren't actually quantitative estimates of how big the signal would be, so it might have been invisible to those. And my favorite candidate is that it's pair density wave order, which is also fiendishly difficult to detect. Again, that's taking us even more into the realm of fantasy, so let's stop there.
Okay.
So I'm only as a, if I follow your story correctly, so the main effect of this primary order is not to create some kind of solution in nesting. Instead, it's actually kind of changing the interaction for the CPW, and then you can get, So because you mentioned there's a primary order.
Yeah.
So the main effect of this primary order is not to introduce some kind of Fermi-Sertin-Nesting preferred for speed up. It's actually more like the change of interaction for the speed up.
So I think what you're saying is that I haven't proved that this other primary order parameter isn't driven by Fermi-Sertin-Nesting.
Well, I mean,
I agree with you. Since I don't know what it is, it's very hard for me to rule out anything about it. Okay. All I'm saying is that I've shown that the charge density wave order can't be driven by Fermi surface nested. So if it was driven by being parasitic on some other order parameter, then it's driven by being parasitic on that other order parameter, and the mechanism is whatever causes the primary order parameter.
Okay.
Why have you backed away from possible pneumatic order?
So I certainly think there's pneumatic order here, but pneumatic order is at Q equals zero. So it can't have a charge density wave order living on its back. It can be a vestige of charge density wave order. So I can construct pneumatic order as a composite of charge density wave. So
I thought you might construct a pneumatic order that would give you the arcs, and then once you have the arcs, who knows what will happen.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't think the pneumatic order by itself can give you the arcs, but certainly pneumatic fluctuations are one possible way of generating arcs. I agree with that. So, I would certainly love to fold pneumatic order into this story as well, but I'm trying to keep my focus on what's causing the charge density wave order, so that's why it doesn't appear now. Yeah, so as I said, pneumatic order, if at all, would be related as a composite of the charge density wave order.
Now, Steve, I have a question about
my mind goes slowly. That's at the order parameter coupling level, that's true. I mean, we know from numerical studies, that if we, you showed this, that if you purposely put in pneumatic order by breaking the symmetry of your underlying microscopic model and make, say, the Hopping matrix elements in one direction different than the other, that vastly enhances charge density wave order. So here I'm talking at the, you know, sort of order parameter field theory perspective, but at some microscopic level, I think what you're saying may well be an important piece of the physics, so thank you. Sorry, Werner.
No. I want to come back to your first, let's say, simplified mean field description of, let's say, density response. If you really look at this in more detail, then you have so-called local field effects, which are now known to be very important if you have localized electronic properties involved. And that is to say, if I apply an external perturbation with your wave vector Q, you are setting up immediately all kinds of short-range responses in the crystal, which come from the backscattering, if you like, of the external electrical field or whatever, on these chaotically oriented lattice sites. And this is included, or has to be included, in the internal field, and when you set up the response, that totally washes out this nice condition that the Q is related to the interband or joint at zero states. And couldn't that already be sort of a microscopic explanation that in general I shouldn't even expect in systems where I have localized electronic properties to have clear Fermi surface matching condition?
So I think what you're saying is the following. So first place, I've simplified this equation to the simplest possible equation. I've had only one band and one Q. With one band, yeah, this should really be a matrix, and it should couple this to chi at Q plus reciprocal lattice vectors.
Yeah.
Okay, and then if there are multiple bands, there should be band indices, and all of these things should be complicated matrices.
Yeah,
but I don't think that makes any difference for the basic conclusion. Chi still will not generically have any divergences. So both the structure of this interaction will be important in determining the ordering vector, and will only get charge ordering when V is on the order of the bandwidth.
But this is a major effect because
I agree with you.
The optical data, let's say on silicon, if you just do the same for the optics, Q 10 into 0, there are shifts by 2 or whatever electron volts. So this is a major effect.
Yeah, I agree. So this equation is certainly a cartoon of what the actual equation is.
Okay. People are not erudite enough to still go on asking, so I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Thanks very much.